Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 28th of January. Roger Hart is a professor of environmental psychology, City University of New York, co-director of the Children's Environments Research Group, and he's working on a film and a book that is tentatively titled Childhood Revisited. In 1972, while he was a graduate student at Clark University, he set out to understand the geography of childhood. He went to a village in Vermont and spent 2 years tracking the movements of human children in their natural environment. He said at that time, "We know more about the ecology of baboons than the ecology of children." So he spent time running, playing, and digging in the dirt with kids from 5 to 12 years old. And he returned to the same town. What an interesting thing to do 2 years ago to repeat his research and to learn how childhood has changed in 36 years. He discovered a universe transformed in a single generation. Children, as you can imagine, moved inside, and the outdoor play world they had once invented and inhabited on their own was gone, which leaves questions about the effects on children's creativity and independence. So we're going to be speaking with Roger Hart this hour of the program, and I have a feeling we'll get a lot of calls on this as you think about your childhood and also your children's childhood and what has created this movement inside. Is it fear that we have that something's going to happen to our children? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Roger Hart, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Thanks for inviting me.
Did you think you were going to do this or 36 years later?
No, I didn't then, but I have known for the last 10 years or so that I really needed to return. Because, you know, there's a story to be told, clearly. There's a lot of speculation in the press, but not a lot of really hard information about how children's lives have been changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about your childhood. You, as we can hear in your voice, grew up in England, and you didn't go barefoot because I guess you didn't do that in England. But did you have special places outside that you went with your friends when you were young?
Oh, yes. I mean, my childhood was like childhoods of the past generation in the United States. There, once I was about 6 years of age, there really weren't any restrictions. One just came in at mealtime. I lived on the edge of a city, a small town that has now been overrun by the city of Nottingham. But, you know, England has changed even faster than the United States. The mobility, the freedom of children in the UK now is the same as in the United States. It's just gone from a situation where about 25 years ago, every child walked to school to one where very few children walked to school.
How do they get there?
Oh, they're driven by people in vehicles. So now we have tremendous traffic problems at those times of the day when vehicles are, you know, clamoring to get to the schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a small part of the issue, though. It's, you know, everybody talks about the obesity problem, and that's very related to it. There's a lot more implications than just obesity to this problem.
You know, and I can vividly remember, I grew up in what was then a suburb of Chicago that was just being built. It was a cornfield, and all these houses were built. But I remember having tremendous freedom, as you did too. We would ride our bicycles into forest preserves and chicken coops and miles away from home. And I'm sure my parents never worried at all. When I think about allowing my son to do that, I would never allow him to do that. We didn't get in any trouble. It was great freedom. But I'm trying to think in terms of my own parenting, what the heck happened? Why do we not allow our children that kind of freedom to explore?
Yeah, it's a complicated story.
Yeah.
I mean, you covered a lot of the ground in your little introduction just now, but it's not just about fear. Certainly, I think the media have done a lot to create paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
There are no indications that kidnapping has gone up dramatically or, you know, even sexual abuse, you know, that's something that used to be hidden a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we know that most sexual abuse is within families and not from outsiders. Sad to say that, but it seems to be the case. It's friends and family that are known. And so the idea that somehow it's become more dangerous out there socially, I think, is incorrect. But there are a lot of other factors. It used to be when you grew up and when I grew up, many mothers were not at work, So we've now got two parents working when there are two parents. We've got all of the seduction of the media indoors, although I don't think that's the majority reason. The major reason, we've got a tremendous lot of pressure in the United States for children to aggressively compete with one another academically, which has resulted in more homework and more after-school programs. It's humorous to me that the United States used to look with sadness towards Japan, you know, and all the extra hours Japanese children were doing in after-school programs, Jidokan, they call it there. But in the last 10 years or so, Japan's been really trying to recover from that. They realized that the creativity, inventiveness of their children has been affected, as well as their social relations and the quality of their life psychologically. So they've actually tried to open up as we've gone the other way and basically copied what Japan used to have. And we have tremendous after-school time now, eaten up with programmed activity.
Go back 36 years to this group of...
87 children there, yeah.
How many were there?
87.
87.
All the children in the town.
Oh, my gosh.
Very small town.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. You must have had such fun. and tell me about the outdoor places that they considered their own and the kind of relationship they had with nature and how important that may have been.
Two big questions, both of those. The issue of children's relationship with nature has recently come to the attention of a lot of people in this country. There's been an excellent book by Richard Louv on that subject. The issue of the kinds of places that they had that were really special to children is interesting. I had wondered what I was going to find these last 2 years related to that, because 35 years ago, every child had multiple places that were either built or discovered by them and known usually only by them, not even by their parents or other adults. That's almost unknown now. Yeah. I mean, when children do have built places, they've usually been built by their grandparents with them or for them or their parents. There aren't as many of those kinds of places, but they're usually not invented and built by children. One of the kids, when I called her up, she said to me, and she had one of the most beautiful houses I remember. I called it River House. It had five rooms on the edge of a river. All the rooms were made of stone furniture, stone telephones, all kinds of stuff like that. I called her up, not having spoken to her for over 30 years. And she said, "Oh, my God, my childhood happened." I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "I'm always telling my children and others what we used to do and trying to get them to be creative outdoors, and I sometimes wonder if I really had that childhood." and then I said to her, "Well, I actually have film of you," and of course she went into screams of excitement. And so it's been great to be able to show them the film and to see the reactions of not only them but their children to film that I wasn't able to show them then for reasons that were technical. We had problems with the footage, but now with digital remastering, we're able to show them all their film. It's very exciting, emotionally intense for me.
What does it mean, Roger? You said something really interesting, that they built these places or discovered places, and only they knew they were that they were there, that the adults didn't know, the parents didn't know, it was theirs.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that's startling, it isn't that parents didn't used to care about children, but they used to allow children to get on with the business of playing and learning from one another with a trust. And when I ask parents about the nature of their children's play, most of them now talk about how they play with their children now. And then I say to them, "Well, you know, did you ever play with your parents?" And they said, "Oh, no, maybe with my father, basketball once in a while." And we go fishing or something with father. But the idea of a mother or a father sitting down and engaging in imaginative play with children was extremely rare. And now it's very common. And another factor that we didn't mention, by the way, is families are smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And if you combine smaller families with the problem that kids can't go very far because of fear and all the other factors we've discussed, what that means is that children either have to have a play date, which is prearranged and can't happen all the time, or they demand playtime with their parents. And sadly, many of my colleagues in psychology have actually told parents it's good for them to play with their children because you can guide them educationally. And there's, again, back to the educational emphasis. There isn't much trust that children learn through play by themselves. That's a real error in how I think we're thinking of children's development. Children need time where they themselves are directing their own activities, alone and with peers, both kinds of time. Alone sometimes, because children need to learn how to direct their activities. Many of my parents complain that when their kids are alone, they are constantly complaining that they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they insist that they don't remember that, and I don't remember that either.
Yeah.
I don't remember that being a problem.
So you go back 36 years later, and what did you find, Roger?
Oh, well, I've just finished collecting all the data, which is an enormous task, and now I'm transcribing it all and writing.
Mm.
So everything I can tell you at this stage is from the top of my head, from my interviews. So I wouldn't be able to give you figures. I can tell you, though, for example, when I ask them questions like, how much time did you spend outside on a good day, a good weather day, when you were under 12? And my parents confirm what I saw. They say, well, more than 75%. When I ask them about their own children, they usually say, in almost all cases, 25% or less in one generation. In terms of their spatial range, most children who are preschool up to 6 years of age never play outside alone. They're always under supervision. And many older than that, and it'll be interesting to try to map that out precisely, but many 7, 8, 9-year-olds just are not allowed to ever play outside alone. 35 years ago, by the time the boys were 9, sometimes 10, they had no restrictions whatsoever.
Hmm.
The parents didn't know where they were. Hmm. The girls were a little more restricted, but the girls, by the time they were 10 or 11, were usually free too. The thing about girls is they were expected more often to be on call for looking after younger children or to do chores with their parents. That's true all over the world. It's that inequity in girls' freedom.
Right.
But it's a big difference. Children now are not allowed to have the kind of freedom they had at 9 years of age until they're in junior high school. But even then, you know, they're expected to phone in and to let people know where they are.
I was reading an interview with you in the Boston Globe, I believe, and you talk about this gross underestimation we have mm-hmm. of children's competence.
Right. Right.
It's interesting. We don't think of them as competent, do we?
Right. I mean, like you with your stories, when I was 13, I cycled all over England, staying in youth hostels with two other 13-year-olds.
Oh, my gosh. Did you really?
Yeah. Whereas my brother, raising his children in England, their kids barely were able to cycle on the street down the road, you know,
from
the house. So these are massive differences. And it has been hyped by the media. Many of my parents are questioning silently to themselves. And so the reason for doing this research is I really want to encourage towns and neighborhoods of cities to have intergenerational dialogues, to have parents and grandparents and children come together and talk about these changes. So, you know, communities can start to think about what is possible to improve conditions. We have something growing rapidly in Europe. I've just come back from Switzerland, in fact, where many, many cities are calling themselves child-friendly cities now and pursuing strategies to make neighborhoods safer. They, for example, in London, they call them home zones. Some of it's traffic calming. Sometimes it's closing a street. The Dutch, for example, for years have made cul-de-sacs. They've closed the ends of thousands of streets, originally to try to stop traffic coming through, traffic dangers. But they found that when they closed the street started to feel also more confident socially. They felt they could challenge strangers who might walk through. It no longer became everybody's territory. It was kind of a place where you could just ask questions. And now they feel confident to let their children play on the sidewalks again.
So what happens when children move inside? What happens to their creativity, to their... What's wrong with it?
That's a great question, and it's not something that I would give a dogmatic answer to.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about psychology is that a lot of these big questions can't be answered other than experimentally, which wouldn't be realistic anyway. We can only imagine from theory and from other research what the implications might be. Many would say that the internet and computer programs allow children to construct, to invent, to be creative, just in another medium.
Mm-hmm.
My own perspective on that is that there are a number of limitations with what one could do with electronic media, and not the least of which is, in the end, children need to know concretely how to manipulate. You can't just go straight into virtual environments. Those virtual environments have to be mentally connected to something that you have touched and handled and manipulated beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So young children definitely need to have those manipulation opportunities. They have to have that play. It cannot be replaced by the computer. So in New York City, we're experimenting now with new kinds of playgrounds, which instead of just fixed play equipment, the park commissioner and David Rockwell, the designer, have joined partnership, and we're working to build the first imagination playground, which will have lots of loose parts. And we'll have play workers who put these parts out. They won't direct play, but they'll set the stage for children to play richly. With, you know, not just water and sand, but construction materials and cranes and pulleys and all this stuff.
Mm.
The things that city kids, especially low-income city kids, have no access to. They just don't have that opportunity in their apartments. And they certainly don't have a chance to do it with other children, inventing with their peers rather than with adults directing them. So that's an exciting adventure. And the Parks Commissioner is very progressive in New York City. Begins all of his meetings these days on this subject by doing what you did with the audience, asking people to go back and remember their childhoods and to contrast them with today as a kind of motivation to get people to really wake up and think about what we've done to childhood and what we can practically do to return some of the qualities that we've taken from children.
Roger Hart is our guest, professor of environmental psychology at the City University of New York, co-director of Children's Environments Research Group. He's working on a film and a book that has that's been in process for a long time, because in 1972 he went to a village in Vermont and spent a couple years tracking the movements of children, 87 children, I believe he said, 87, in their natural environment, and running and playing and building forts and having places that they built and discovered and only they knew about them. Adults didn't know about them. And then he went back 2 years ago to repeat his research and to see how childhood had changed in 36 years. And he found that children had moved inside, the outdoor world that they had been so much a part of was gone. And what kind of questions does that leave us with? So we're talking about that this hour of the program. This will eventually become a book and also a movie. Well, let's go to phone calls. He has us all thinking about our childhoods, doesn't he? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Or if you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go to phone calls, and we start with Jay from South Milwaukee. Hi, Jay.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I grew up in the 1960s in a small northern Wisconsin town. It was rural woodlands and lake area, and when I was a child, we spent all of our time outside, summer and winter, walking through the woods, making imaginary forts. We didn't have a lot of money for toys, and most of them we either invented or made up ourselves. And I had just a wonderful childhood. I've since moved into the city, and I have three daughters. One is a teen, and two are preteens. And I find that also none of them seem to want to play outside. If they're not sitting in front of the computer, they have an MP3 player plugged in,
mm-hmm.
or they're watching television. They always seem to want to have some kind of input, something already prepackaged for them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they'll want to do their homework with the television on and the MP3 player plugged in. And it just seems kind of dehumanizing, and I wonder if that's really healthy. I have a great concern over it. They don't seem to want to do anything outside or create any kind of play or imaginary world for themselves. Does your guest feel that this is really something to be concerned about? I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Excellent. I think one of the really unfortunate implications of this is that we're raising children who are less resourceful, less inventive, and I'd like to use another term, less adaptive. One thing we all now know, I think it's generally being accepted, is that we are going to have climate change in a rapid way all over the world. And those people who are struggling now to come to grips with this, we've just got meetings going on with the United Nations right now here in New York, a lot of them, realize that what the public's going to have to do is be a much more adaptive public than it's been in the past. Already the rate of disasters has gone up enormously. Adaptation comes from basically having a childhood experience where you learn to respond to conditions in the real world, not in an imaginary world. And you often use the imagination to help you be creative with that, to find new solutions. Children coming together and making places is really important. And the question you asked earlier, Kathleen, about what about children's relationship to nature? Well, everything I've read suggests that free experiences as children with nature are so much more important for developing a caring concern for the natural world than any amount of classes on environmental education or ecology or even films. Mm-hmm. Films come closest, but it's still not the same as a spontaneous engagement with the natural world. If you read the autobiographies of people who have spent their lives as adults caring for nature, you find this story about the kind of freedom they had to be in natural settings. And so I think we're losing a lot by not having opportunities for children to develop this caring concern for local places and natural settings.
And the transfer, when our listener talked about, you know, the MP3 and the Wii players, this generation is really plugged in. And I find it just astounding. And it's hard to escape it, certainly, because all their friends are as well. So they got this text messaging, and you're walking around with your cell phone in your pocket, and you got to be in touch with everybody. Very rarely are you talking on the phone. You know, you're talking via the computer. It is very electronic. And I don't know what that means. But it's such a different part of their lives. They have to be in touch all the time.
Yeah, in touch or out of touch.
Yeah, right.
And out of touch with the place they're in. I mean, one of the things that astounds me is the degree to which people are not connected to the people around them. So there's a loss of sense of community very often because they're talking to somebody in another place.
Mm-hmm.
And some would say, well, that's a way of maintaining their community. Well, it might be a way of maintaining their own network, but it doesn't help strengthen what I would like to call public space. I don't think it helps build trust and confidence with those who are around us physically. And that's really important, not only for feeling good and secure, but I would go so far as to say for being a democracy. You know, I worry about the fact that face-to-face contacts with neighbors are really going down the hill fast now because children are not out there in the streets. We know from old research that the way parents even would even get to know each other in neighborhoods was through their children's networks. Today, it's true that if you have a dog, you're likely to know other dog owners. Dogs are great for getting to meet neighbors, but they're not as good as thousands of kids out there getting to know each other in play and often bringing their adults together. So there's another whole dimension to this, which is the loss of the sense of belonging to community, the loss of public space.
Right.
You know, it's a vicious cycle. People are frightened to go outside, so they stay inside, but then it becomes more frightening outside because there's no longer a sense of community out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Frank from Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi,
Frank. Very good topic, as usual. I would like to ask, is there data that shows that children have, in fact, lost both children's games, traditional children's games, and children's rhymes, for instance. Like, I don't see in playgrounds children grouped in a way that would indicate that they play Red Rover anymore. And then I have a second question, you know, is what we're worried about real? Not that I doubt it, but I'd like to know if there's data. And the second is, isn't it to a degree that we've built suburbs and communities around cars? And so the alternative of being able to function as a child in public or public but private space actually isn't there anymore. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Frank, as always.
Well, the first question about the loss of traditional games, the kinds of games that were handed down children to children, even though all adults knew them, they used to be passed on, didn't they, largely from children to children. They still occur, but there are less opportunities for children to engage in those kinds of activities. So there's no question that there's been a reduction in that. I wasn't able to interview children this time around as much as I did 35 years ago, partly because it's so much harder to arrange times to see them. Mm. When I did the work 35 years ago, I got all the agreement from parents in town at the beginning, and then I would just turn up a child's home and just go off with them. Inconceivable now. What that means is that I don't have as much time with children. I've had to get most of my data from their parents. When I do talk to the children, I learned towards the end of the 2 years a really fast way of getting into their world that I wished I'd realized at the beginning. If I just ask them one question, tell me about the times when you are not under control of adults, when you're not being required to do something by adults, and they jump to the answer. Nobody's ever asked them this before, but they have it in their heads, and they say things like, well, before soccer practice, while we're waiting around, and then after soccer practice, while we're waiting to be picked up, and then on the way to school in the school bus, or but even that's not so good now because now they have video in the school bus to see what we're doing. So, you know, it goes like that. They're very aware of those few moments when they are able to invent their activities with their peers. It's a sad statement.
That is a sad statement.
Because that used to be enormous. And so the caller who asked about the loss of those traditional games, you know, yes, that was part of what children used to do in peer culture. But we still have peer culture. Obviously, children do communicate with one another, but they don't get the chance to do it in any high degree until they get into their teenage years. And then peer culture becomes very strong indeed. And I've not been studying that. You know, my focus is up to 12 years of age. But I think it's an interesting question. What that means, that kids suddenly get, when they're in their teens, the chance to start building their own cultures, which adults are often not in on at all, and to certainly use the internet increasingly to do that, and to talk with each other in languages that are quite unique, they would be equivalent to the kinds of stuff that the folklorists, you know, who study traditional games. Because what was interesting about those old traditional games the reader asked about, the listener asked about, is that they were always being modified. You know, every year they would get twisted a little bit as children added new language to them. And there are a lot of folklorists who studied that, the way rhyming games just change over time. That stuff, I think, still happens with teenagers. They're inventing culture. It's the younger children that don't really have the chance to do that. And parents are, by and large, keeping them off of the internet and email and instant communication through computers. That's not really happening much yet with preteens.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Frank, for the call. We go to Ed from West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Well, the other aspect of geography on childhood is the sterility, ugliness, and barrenness of modern architecture. When someone in New York City was growing up in the 1940s and 50s, they could go into the Marble Rotunda at Ebbets Field for a baseball game or into Pennsylvania Station on 33rd and 7th, and you would see the children, and their first exclamation would be, wow. They would see this marvelous architecture, this wonderment, and they would just their whole imagination would be engaged, versus walking into one of these trapezoids. We have something in Chicago now. We have a kidney being on Michigan Avenue at the Pritzker Center, and there's just absolutely no engagement anymore, and they recoil from it. So that's another aspect I think you have to consider.
Roger?
Well, you know, yes, you're right that children can be moved by monumental architecture. Here in New York City, we still have lots of that. You know, we did lose Pennsylvania Station, but the Museum of Natural History still awes children when they walk into it. I'm glad to say we've still got a lot of them. I think architecture can have that wow effect. I'm personally more concerned with how the designed or planned world affects children day to day. And again, I'd have to agree with the caller. Beyond the issue of aesthetics, what a place looks like, places can encourage or enable children to feel safe and to play with one another or not. And a lot of what I'm interested in coming out of this kind of research that I'm doing is to create spaces where parents feel that when they let their children go outside, their friends, their neighbors will be looking out for them. I already mentioned to you the idea of the cul-de-sac closing a street at one end. It's such a simple idea, mm-hmm. but it has massive effects. There are other things you can do like that. We've known for years that when families live above two stories, parents can't feel confident letting children go out to play because you break that opportunity for visual surveillance and for listening and talking. And so there's a lot of concern with those who build child-friendly communities in Europe to maintain that parent-child interaction to create high-density but very low-rise communities. We have to think more about this, and I'm glad to say there are hundreds of towns now around the world and cities that are calling themselves child-friendly that are working on this problem.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about this. You talk about some kids at the school. When you went back to this town 36 years later, they tried to give you a room in a school to do the research, but you hung out more on the playground because otherwise you're going to be another teacher who wants that.
Yeah.
But you talk about some of the children trying to build grass forts in a field outside the school.
All right.
And they didn't know how to put a roof on, so they came to you and you got that trust built immediately.
Yeah, well, I think it's something that anybody who works with children knows, that you know, you allow children to come to you and to slowly trust that they will determine if you're an okay person to hang out with. And once that's established, you know, the word then gets home to parents, and then parents feel better, and the network is established. So that's the way I did it. And I just remembered that first day. It's ironic that it was about building, because that became such a theme of the research, is how much I noticed children build places for themselves. But, yeah, the first contact I had with children in that town was children struggling to build forts with grass. The school was very progressive in that it allowed me to be there and to have a different relationship with the children, and not to see that as in any way undermining their authority and respect as teachers. Because it obviously is a different issue to be an adult who's working outdoors with children and listening to them versus someone who has to communicate knowledge to children in a large class of 25 or 30 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very lucky to have a school that understood that.
Mm-hmm. An email, great show. I have a one-year-old, and I'm thinking a lot about his future. What is the name of the book that you're writing, Roger? Because this person wants to read it right now.
Oh, boy. I don't know that yet. Revisiting Childhood is just a working title.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It does appear to me that the play is one of the dominant issues, if not the dominant one, that parents are giving me. So play will probably be in the title. I tried to be open in my interviews and to be a bit broader than I was in my original research and ask parents to talk to me about the biggest changes in children's lives outside of school. Whereas before, I was really just interested in the out-of-doors and the kind of the geographic exploration of children. I've had to open it up a little bit because I really wanted to learn about the whole question of social relationships, too. But at the top of the list, when I ask them about the biggest changes, the first one is the limited freedom of their children. Closely related to that is the fact that their children are programmed in time. Quickly on the heels of that, I think, comes their fears about the loss of imaginativeness and inventiveness of their children.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, you know, one of your callers mentioned the issue of not having money for toys. Even my poorest families feel they have too many toys for their children.
Hmm.
It's something that everybody buys toys and then regrets it. And
mm-hmm.
you can see them at birthday parties almost working out, okay, what are we going to do with that toy and who are we going to give that to? It's an enormous problem. And, you know, there just isn't the caring for things as a result. And there's not the realization by children that they can invent toys themselves. That's connected to that whole theme of loss of inventiveness. Yeah.
Roger Hart is our guest, professor of environmental psychology, City University of New York, co-director of Children's Environments Research Group. He's working on a film and a book that has – he's not – wedded to this, but as he said, it's tentatively titled Childhood Revisited. He's done some remarkable research. In 1972, he was a graduate student. He wanted to understand the geography of childhood and went to a village in Vermont and spent 2 years tracking the lives of some, well, all the children who lived there, 87 children. He decided to go back to find out what had happened to childhood, so he went back 2 years later, 36 years later, to the same place and found that children weren't outside anymore. They'd all moved inside, and what that means for childhood and creativity, etc. More phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls, and we go to Diane from Coon Valley. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I work at a nature and heritage center just outside Coon Valley called Marskadal, and I know that a lot of the research and everything is about creating communities and free play and such. But I was wondering if there's anything that a heritage center like ours we've got, or a nature center we've got, like about 400 acres of coulee, and I wondered if there's anything that we could do.
Great. Thank you for asking. Nature centers are so important because obviously many children just don't have a contact with the natural environment anymore. I think that a lot that can be done is to help children connect to nature back home and to act as advocates for children and parents to be more in a daily contact with the nature that is close to their homes. You know, there certainly is an important role for nature heritage centers for short-term visits. But that kind of frequent love of place that I've talked about, that kind of enabling children to establish a real affection for a place is also important. And so anything that you can do as a center to support teachers that visit you with groups of kids to go back and really do something significant, not just recycling projects or the usual kind of pre-written curricula, but really asking children to bring into the school their personal experiences with living things in their neighborhood and try to kind of map that. There's nothing children like more than mapping. It's a great activity. And so schools can do a great deal to enable neighborhoods to look at themselves closely and to see what they have and to express their love of the places in their neighborhoods. I think that's something that you could really add to as we go forward in the 21st century into a return to looking at the places that we live in. We have to do that. If we're going to have sustainable development, we have to have local concern. It can't be done by scientists and engineers from a distance.
Great ideas. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane, so much for your call. Well, we need to go to an email. Larry from Madison, I have two questions, Roger. Do you think there'll be a further delay in children discovering their own cities Also, technology has allowed children to play video games outside with iPhones, etc. What are your thoughts on them taking the initiative to play real games, go on hikes, and generally walk or bike around their neighborhoods or city?
That's quite a complex question. I think what she's asking me is about some of the positive sides of technology in terms of exploration. Yeah, there are some. There are some important ones, and I'm glad somebody's giving us a chance to talk about that. We were just talking about kids doing mapping. For navigating and mapping, global positioning systems that enable children to explore where they are and to map it even greater depth are very exciting. One of the children in my research, who was from a family that is particularly confident in their child's abilities, enables this 10-year-old to just go off for hours and hours at an end. And he's got a very inexpensive GPS tool in his hand. And he loves to extend his range further and further, knowing with great confidence how to get back and to use this instrument. So, yes, when technology is used in ways in combination with the outdoors, it can extend rather than limit us.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much for your call, Larry. Let us go next to Rod from Radisson. Hi, Rod.
Hello, and thank you for the program. It's very interesting. And I've seen quite a difference in the town I live in, how children just aren't out and about, you know, regardless of what time of the year it is.
Right.
But I had a comment. You used the word fear when you started, Kathleen, and that seems half of the equation of life today. The other half might be programming, and we are well programmed. That's why the corporations call it consumer program, because it creates programmed consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You want to respond, Roger?
Yeah, I do. There have been some policy decisions at the national level at certain turning points that could have been different. During the Reagan administration, a decision was taken to enable television stations to advertise alongside children's programming. That had previously been decoupled, so it didn't used to be possible before to have half-hour advertisements for televisions like we have now. So when you watch a television program, you'll see in between it the products related to that program being advertised. The result of this is that kids have a lot of toys that come with the entire script written out for those toys. And often the back of the toy will tell you what the script is, too. That was a mistake. I mean, parents have to deal with that. You know, obviously, they try to limit many of them how many hours their children watch television.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the kids in this town are allowed to watch the cartoons on Saturday morning. It's almost an American tradition. It would be good to uncouple again, to not allow corporations to control the buying agendas of children, to just have them watch television but not have advertisements in between the programs of all the products. So that's not a complete answer to the gentleman's call, but it is just one example of how we've got choices as a nation, and we haven't always taken the best ones for children. And that was really a... There used to be an organization called Action for Children's Television that campaigned hard against it.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
They're still around, I think, aren't they?
I guess they must be, but I haven't heard them for a few years. And
no.
they did such a great job in fighting that, but lost in the end.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Leslie from Preston, Minnesota. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Kathleen. What a wonderful show. I'm just so excited thinking about this. I was such a tomboy when I was a kid.
Mm.
We played outside all the time. I had five brothers, and we just could get up and be gone. Had to be home for meals, for sure, for lunch and supper, and then after supper, we could go to the skating rink till 9 o'clock when we were just little. And as I got older, we got more strict rules. But what you said about toys is so true, too. I'm a grandmother now, and my sister, when she had grandkids, she bought them everything under the sun. I mean, just spent tons of money on them. And I'm just the complete opposite. I think the most fun that my kids had when they were little was with like a big refrigerator box, and we taped it together with duct tape. And my husband showed them how to use a knife, a little utility knife, and he showed them how he took it out a little bit so they could cut through the box to make windows and doors.
Right.
And then we showed them how to get it back down. And they were little. I mean, they could have cut themselves, but he showed them, and they were really good with it. And then they put it back in when they were done cutting, and they put it out a little when they wanted to make another window or something. But I drugged those in and out of the house until they were just tattered, you know, and they played in those for hours.
Yeah.
But one thing I see nowadays, how I grew up, we had a woods and creeks and stuff, and we just were out playing. Now, when I go back to my old neighborhood, that's all apartments now. I think, how can kids grow up?
Mm.
There's nowhere to go for those kids like we had. But one thing I can see for this type of society, if you can get a cheap camper or a tent is better, and take your kids camping from day one. I always thought, oh, they have to be a little older before they can go camping. So our first kid, we didn't go right away. And then the next kids, we took them right with us, because there's nothing better than taking your kids camping. They learn so much. They could go out and explore in a kind of a controlled but safe area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we knew where they were. They could go and meet other kids that were camping and come back. And then they got to just be pro campers after a while. And now when they're in college, they're always going camping with their friends and kids that have never camped before in the camping. And they just are outdoor people.
Mm-hmm. Roger.
Yeah, terrific suggestions. I think, yeah, for parents who are wondering how they can deal with some of these problems, the suggestion of teaching children skills that relate to using natural resources and how to get by and how to build things, these are all useful because it liberates the children then to do things with their friends. Camping is great. Again, a chance for the family to be resourceful. But it made me think of another point that we haven't discussed yet that's really interesting. You know, not only has children's freedom to be with their friends outdoors changed a lot, but also children don't belong to membership organizations as much as they used to. And with those membership organizations like the Cubs and the Scouts and the 4-H, obviously they still exist. It's just the membership is way down.
Mm.
And it's way down all over the industrialized world. It's not just the United States. One of the things those organizations allowed was for kids to do things with each other, with adults who weren't necessarily directing all of their activities, but were giving them skills that enabled them to do things with each other that were engaged with materials and were about building and were about construction and inventing and relating to nature and hunting and fishing and agriculture and stuff. So that it's sad that that's gone down the drain. And I think one of the reasons is a lot of those organizations have not tried to update themselves. I mean, they are often too programmed. They're, you know, after all, the Scouts came out of a military organization, and they kind of structure of patrols and patrol leaders and so on, and the badges, and it's quasi-militaristic. And I think we could do a lot more to think about providing after-school opportunities for children that are not all programmed. It amazes me, even in, you know, this town that I'm studying, they've got a great after-school program with all kinds of volunteer parents helping run things. But in talking to the children, they say to me, there's not one after-school program that's called play. So there's no chance for them to just be in a safe space, as far as adults can, and do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really serious. And I think it's related to a loss of trust by parents that children will know how to do something with each other that is valuable to their development. I mean, I have to say this rather strongly. A lot of the programming emphasis is coming from parents who want to push their kids to perform competitively in an increasingly aggressive economic
yes,
world.
Right.
And they're frightened that if they don't direct their children into
right.
those activities, if they don't spend all their time doing something that they, as adults, have decided their children need to do to be smarter, then the kids are wasting their time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are making an enormous mistake, because if children don't get the chance to invent their own activities sometimes, that's, in terms of their success economically in the future, that's an erosion. it's an erosion of the creativity and inventiveness and the ability of children to actually cooperate with others and to work, you know, in teams inventively. Parents get in the way of that all the time. We've watched children who are parents in settings where kids play. And we've actually done it very closely in a playground in New York for disabled children that tries to integrate special needs children. And children never get the chance to really play with each other in those settings because the minute they're about to interact, some adult comes along and says, oh, yes, you could help Johnny do that. And that kills it. So there isn't this ability. Parents need to improve their ability to stand back and let children play. And then if they do observe that their kids are not doing something that they might like them to do, then they could provide the resources on the sidelines, or they could even demonstrate, not by teaching them, but by doing something that they want, that they think is interesting on the sidelines, but not directing children all the time.
We're out of time, Roger. A lot of people on this end are ready for your book, so I hope it's going to be our way soon. Thank you.
I'll do it as fast as I can.
Thank you. Roger Hart, professor of environmental psychology at the City University of New York and co-director of Children's Environments Research Group. His book and movie tentatively titled Childhood Revisited. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Tretter for on-air production here in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls. News ahead, we'll be with you again tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.